Good afternoon, listeners. This is the DOLS program, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday to defend and to promote public education. And not only are we promoting public education, we also are prepared to say we are against the public funding of private schools. We have a very full program for you this afternoon, and we have our press release 1066, and this is about the Victorian teachers who are now on a collision course with the Labor Party, Allan government. So let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. This is press release number 1066. Victorian Teachers and Allan government on collision course. The Victorian Teachers Union says school staff have been forced to escalate industrial action from the start of Term 2 after the state government turned down its demand for a 35% pay increase and improved working conditions. The government offered a mere 17% pay increase instead. As well as falling far short of the 35% pay increase, the government offer failed to address workloads, unpaid overtime, and chronic staff shortages. The union says that by October, experienced teachers in Victoria will be earning as much as $15,359 a year, that's $295 per week, less than their New South Wales counterparts. This means that a classroom-based education support employee starting out would be 10.5% behind, and a Victorian school principal new to the role would start $27,841 or 18% behind a similar principal in New South Wales. A recent survey showed public school staff are doing more than 12 hours unpaid overtime per week on average. More than 80% say their workloads have increased due to inadequate support, and only 30% plan to stay working in public schools long term. Although the union supports public schools and its teachers, unlike the DOGS, they have generally been reluctant to confront the state aid to private schools issues. But the union's figures on the gross underfunding of public education in Victoria employ research by Trevor Cobold, an erstwhile economist from the Productivity Commission for 30 years and convener of Save Our Schools. On February 2nd, 2026, in a press release entitled Not the Education State, Victorian Public Schools Remain Massively Underfunded by New Schools Agreement, Cobold noted that a new schools agreement with the Commonwealth Government continued the long-standing massive underfunding of Victorian public schools by billions, while Catholic and independent schools continued to be overfunded. This continued underfunding of public schools is a barrier to reducing the vast inequity in school outcomes between rich and poor students. The new funding agreement was published in the weeks before Christmas without any public announcement by the Albanese or Allan governments. The agreement is only for 2 years, 2025 and 2026, instead of the 10-year agreement with the other states and the ACT, while the Northern Territory has a 5-year agreement. The limited agreement is the result of a continuing standoff between the Commonwealth and Victorian governments over the future funding of public schools. By contrast, with the other states and territories, Victorian public schools do not have their share of the schooling resource standard increased. It will remain at their 2023 and 2024 levels for 2025 and 26 because of the standoff. The Commonwealth share will remain at only 20% of the SRS instead of gradually increasing its share to 25% from 2025 as it has for other states and the ACT, and the Victorian government has refused to increase its funding share. As a result, their SRS funding share will have stayed the same for 4 years. 4 years without an increase in their SRS funding share is diabolical for public schools, especially disadvantaged schools. The agreement also continues the accounting tricks in the previous Morrison and Albanese government agreements that defrauded public schools of an estimated $3.5 billion over 2019 to 2024. The Victorian government can continue to claim on non-SRS expenditures as part of its funding share. It can claim up to 4% of the SRS for capital depreciation and school transport, called the 4% allowance. It can also claim expenditure on the Victorian Curriculum and Assessment Authority and the Victorian Registration and Qualifications Authority, as they relate to public schools. These expenditures are specifically excluded from the national agreement on how the SRS is measured. The Albanese government has even agreed to an additional accounting trick in the new agreement, although it involves a tiny amount of money. Victoria can now also claim its expenditure on the Victorian Institute of Teaching, which was not previously claimable. The Institute of Teaching is funded almost entirely by teacher registration fees. The Institute's website states, "The VIT is funded solely by teacher registration fees and receives no direct funding from the Victorian government. However, it has received small government grants amounting to $316,371 in 2025, according to its pro-rate basis. The Federal Minister for Education has clarified that the Victorian government can only claim funding provided by the Victorian government as part of its SRS share instead of all expenditure by the Institute, which amounted to $23.9 million. The new agreement purports to show that public schools will be funded at 90.43% of their SRS in 2 years. However, this ignores the accounting tricks. The actual share is only 85.8% after adjusting for the accounting tricks. Victorian public schools are the most underfunded systems in Australia in 2026, except for the Northern Territory. So the Victorian Labor government, shortchanged by the Albanese Labor government, just doesn't have the money in Treasury for public schools to pay its teachers. Although it has plenty of funds from the same federal government to pay the overfunded religious schools. Perhaps it's time to take from private to pay public. It is no wonder then that the Victorian Union, pushed into action by fed-up public school teachers, is now stating that public school staff are sick and tired of being overworked and undervalued. They are being taken for granted by the Premier Jacinta Allen and Education Minister Ben Carroll, and will raise their voices around Victoria and significantly escalate their industrial action. The Allen Labor government, employer of the nation's lowest paid public school teachers and underpaid education support staff and principals, needs to start respecting public schools and the hardworking people who educate Victoria's children and young people. The $2.4 billion cut from Victoria's public schools means the state now has the lowest funded public schools in the country. Right now, every state Labor MP should be ashamed of the fact that they think they can call Victoria the education state. And now here's a short clip from AEU Vic branch president Justin Mullaly, detailing some of the action that will be taken in the following weeks.
It's time to turn up the heat. It's time to put more pressure on the government and on the Department of Education. So from the start of term two, we're going to implement more industrial action. We're going to put a ban on written comments in reports. We're going to put a ban on attending 1 hour of meetings, with additional bans in place for principals and their meetings. There'll be a ban on responding to departmental email, and if the department or the government want to roll out any new initiatives, well, they're banned as well. Branch executive met, they heard a report on negotiations and things are not progressing sufficiently. And it's the case that we've got to turn up the heat. They've also decided to roll out further stop work action. So from week three, there will be half-day rolling regional stoppages. You'll find more details in the member email. Please remember though, if you're not a member of the AAU, you're not contributing to getting better pay and conditions, and you can't take industrial action. That means you can't ban meetings, it means you can't ban comments on written reports. Everybody's got to get involved. Everybody's got to join the union. Everybody's got to contribute. Remember, folks, we're stronger together.
So lots more to come. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Dale. But now we've got some more facts and figures from Trevor Cobold.
Thanks, Jean. Resource increases in New South Wales private schools outstrip public schools. And this is an article by Trevor Cobold and published on April the 9th. New figures show that independent schools have a major resource advantage over Catholic and public schools in New South Wales. Government funding increases have favoured Catholic and independent schools over public schools since 2009. Catholic and public schools now have similar resource levels. However, public schools remain massively underfunded for the challenges they face, while independent and Catholic schools are overfunded. The favourable funding for private schools is a key factor behind the enrolment shift to these schools. New figures published by the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, ACARA, show that the total income per student in public schools in 2024 was $20,916, similar to that of Catholic schools at $20,926, but $9,468 per student less than the $30,384 per student in independent schools. The total income per student in independent schools is 45% more than that of public schools. Government funding accounts for 79% of the income of Catholic schools and 44% of the income of independent schools. In 2024, Catholic schools received $16,629 per student from the Commonwealth and New South Wales governments, and independent schools $13,324. Commonwealth and New South Wales government funding, adjusted for wage and price increases to estimate the real increase in human and material resources, increased by similar amounts in public and Catholic schools, $2,832 and $2,902 per student, respectively. Government funding for independent schools increased by $2,243 per student, but the percentage change was much larger for Catholic and independent schools than for public schools. 36% for Catholic schools and 35% independent schools, compared to 27% for public schools. Commonwealth government funding for Catholic schools increased by $2,832 per student and by $2,314 for independent schools, compared to only $1,369 for public schools. New South Wales government funding for public schools increased by $1,463 per student. This was significantly more than the national average for state-territory funding of $972 per student. This increase was instrumental in ensuring that total funding per student in public schools increased by almost the same as for Catholic schools. New South Wales government funding for Catholic schools increased by $70 per student and fell by $71 for independent schools. The increase in total income per student in Catholic and independent schools was much larger than for public schools. It increased by $3,270 in Catholic schools and by $3,580 in independent schools, compared to $2,704 in public schools. It is abysmal that governments continue to ensure that independent schools have a huge resource advantage over public schools when it is public schools that do the heavy lifting in overcoming socioeconomic disadvantage to improve equity in education, increase workforce skills, and strengthen social cohesion. Income per student in independent schools is 45% higher than in public schools. Government funding provides a significant proportion of this resource advantage. Yet, research by Save Our Schools shows that only 10% of independent students in New South Wales are from low-income families, compared to nearly one-third, 32%, of public school students, 2023 figures. Independent schools enrol only 7% of all low-income students in New South Wales, while public schools account for 81% of these students. Moreover, only 8% of independent schools are disadvantaged schools, defined as having over 50% of students from the lowest socio-educationally advantaged quartile, compared to 33% of public schools. Independent schools account for only 4% of all disadvantaged schools in New South Wales, while public schools account for 94%. While New South Wales Catholic schools have a similar total resource level per student to public schools, Catholic schools have an effective resource advantage because they educate a much smaller proportion of socially disadvantaged students than do public schools. This means that a lower proportion of Catholic school income is absorbed by disadvantaged students and more is available to less disadvantaged students. In 2023, only 16% of Catholic students were from low-income families, half that in public schools, 32%. Catholic schools enrol only 12% of all disadvantaged students in New South Wales, compared to 81% of these students by public schools. In addition, only 2% of Catholic schools are disadvantaged, over 50% of students from the lowest socio-educationally advantaged quartile, compared to 33% of public schools. Catholic schools account for only 1% of all New South Wales disadvantaged schools, compared to 94% by public schools. The Report on Government Services 2026 shows that 81% of students from low socio-educational families in New South Wales, 82% of Indigenous students, and 80% of remote and very remote area students are enrolled in public schools. Clearly, government funding in New South Wales is not being directed at the students and schools most in need. Historical trends. The pattern of government funding, fees and other income and total income per student have varied between school sectors over the period of 2009 to 2024. Real government, Commonwealth and state and territory funding for public schools fell in both the pre- and post-Gonski periods, declining from $10,343 per student in 2009 to $10,170 in 2015. This was due to a significant reduction in New South Wales government funding, which extended to 2017 and was only offset by Commonwealth funding from 2015. New South Wales government funding fell from $8,979 in 2009 to $8,379 in 2017. Since then, government funding per student has increased significantly, mainly due to increased New South Wales government funding. Total government funding increased by $2,973 per student between 2017 and 2023, but fell by $281 per student in 2024. By contrast, government funding for Catholic and independent schools has increased steadily since 2009. Independent schools received generous Commonwealth financial assistance during COVID under the JobKeeper scheme accounting to $124 million, as well as additional cash flow stimulus payments. Commonwealth funding for Catholic schools increased by $346 per student in 2020 and by $637 in independent schools. Government funding for Catholic schools as a proportion of funding for public schools increased from 77% in 2009 to 86% in 2020 and reduced to 83% in 2024. The independent school proportion increased from 63% to 75% in 2020 and has fallen to 66% in 2024. Income from fees, charges, donations, investments and other sources in Catholic and independent schools has increased by more than wage and price increases since 2009. Adjusting for wage and price increases, the source of income increased by $368 per student in Catholic schools and by $1,150 in independent schools between 2009 and 2024. Income from these sources fell by $29 per student in public schools. Prior to COVID, income from fees and other private sources increased by $178 per student adjusted for inflation in Catholic schools and by $1,356 in independent schools. In 2020, this income fell by $357 per student in Catholic schools and by $791 in independent schools. JobKeeper and the cash flow stimulus payments allowed Catholic and independent schools to reduce their fees in 2020. Nominal fees in Catholic schools fell by $234 per student and by $417 in independent schools. Income from donations and other private sources also fell in 2020 in both sectors. Since 2020, income from fees and other sources have increased faster than inflation in Catholic and independent schools. Public schools also experienced a drop in income from fees and donations in 2020 from $601 to $356 per student. The combination of increased government funding and income from fees and other private sources has enabled private schools to build a substantial resource advantage over public schools since 2009. In 2009, total income per student adjusted for inflation in public schools was $506 higher than in Catholic schools. This advantage was eliminated by 2013, and Catholic schools have maintained a small advantage over public schools ever since, except for 2023. increased government funding and private income has magnified the resource advantage of independent schools. In 2009, the total income per student in independent schools was $5,366 higher than in public schools. By 2024, this had increased to $6,242, and their total income per student was 146% of that of public schools. The resource advantage of independent schools has declined in recent years as a result of the fall in real income from private sources and increased government funding for public schools. Despite the small reduction in the resource advantage held by Catholic and independent schools, public schools remain vastly underfunded for the task they face in educating the large majority of low socioeconomic status, Indigenous, remote, very remote, and high disability students. As noted above, public schools do the heavy lifting in education, but are not funded to do the job. Underfunding of public schools. In 2026, public schools in New South Wales are funded at 90% of their schooling resource standard, the SRS. The total underfunding for the year is estimated at $1.8 billion. Under the terms of the new bilateral funding agreements, public schools will remain underfunded to 2034 and beyond, although the extent of the underfunding will gradually decline to about $890 million in 2034. By contrast, Catholic and independent schools in New South Wales are overfunded at 102% of their SRS, as revealed in figures supplied to the Senate estimates and in the bilateral funding agreement. Public schools will remain underfunded until at least 2034 because the new bilateral funding agreement between the Commonwealth and New South Wales governments allow the New South Wales government to continue to claim non-SRS expenditure as part of its share of funding public schools. It can claim capital depreciation up to 4% of the SRS as part of its share of funding public schools, but the percentage share allowed will be reduced annually by small amounts until it is eliminated in 2034. The New South Wales government is also allowed to claim other non-SRS expenditure as part of its share of funding public schools. It can continue to claim expenditure on the Education Standards Authority and up to 1.8% of the SRS on non-SRS expenditure allowed in bilateral agreements with other governments, most of which are for direct school transport or public school students. These concessions ensure that public schools will still be underfunded in 2034, even though the 4% allowance will end in 2034. The Commonwealth and the New South Wales government stand condemned for their refusal to fully fund public schools by 2034. It means that children starting school this year will not be fully funded by year 8 and possibly will spend their whole school career underfunded if they remain in public system. The failure to fully fund public schools maintains inequity in education, increases social segregation, and restricts national prosperity and social cohesion. The Commonwealth and New South Wales governments should accelerate the transition to genuine full funding of all public schools. The funding agreements must be revised to give public schools better and fairer funding. The Commonwealth should accelerate the increase in its funding share of the SRS public schools to achieve 25% by 2029, and the New South Wales government should remove the existing 4% and regulatory expenditure allowances by 2029. Back to you, Jean.
Well, that's pretty solid stuff, and we always thank Trevor Coble for all the work that he does for the public system. But let's have a break, shall we?
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
Over five decades, we've been home to hundreds of shows, thousands of broadcasters and guests, and hundreds of thousands of listeners.
This February, we're aiming for 1,000 subscribers.
It's just $40 concession, $80 full.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. We're going to take you to a teacher who wants to talk about teaching in the time of ChatGPT.
Thanks, Jean. To teach in the time of ChatGPT is to know pain. And this article was written by Scott K. Johnson and published on the 13th of April in Ars Technica. Large language model use is the most demoralising problem I've faced as a college instructor. I've been teaching college earth science courses as a part-time faculty member for a long time now, all while juggling other jobs. I started because it was enjoyable. No one gets into this line of work for the famously poor pay or complete lack of job security. Working with students is just one of those genuinely fulfilling experiences that is addictive enough that they ought to warn people about it. But thanks to generative AI, it has become mostly miserable, at least in certain settings. For the last few years, I've been exclusively teaching asynchronous online courses, meaning recorded videos rather than live sessions. These have always been a bit more challenging than face-to-face classes, where you have a greater ability to keep the students on track. If a student doesn't have to show up in a room for an hour at a scheduled time, and no one can see their involuntary facial expressions when they don't understand something, the probability increases greatly that they'll just fall off. But since the appearance of ChatGPT, the instructor's job isn't just to teach the subject and frantically attempt to keep every student's plate spinning. Increasingly, it's to moonlight as a detective and prosecutor because students without the motivation to do the work don't have to skip it anymore. They can turn in a work-shaped simulacrum almost as easily, and a substantial number do. In a recent College Board survey of 600 high school students, 84% said they had used generative AI for schoolwork. Teachers are certainly no strangers to cheating, but peeking at concealed notes during an exam or plagiarising paragraphs from Wikipedia are quaint stone tools compared to the weapons of mass destruction known as LLMs. I long for the binary comfort of a simple problem like cheating or not. Now I'm forced to adjudicate 256 shades of grey and provide sufficient documentation to defend my decision in case a student appeals my grading to multiple levels of institutional review panels. Not only does this soul-crushing work consume a shockingly large percentage of my time, but it leaves me with the disturbing thought that even my engaged students might not be what they seem. Maybe they grasped that difficult concept because of my help, or maybe they just laundered an LLM's regurgitation of Wikipedia paragraphs more skillfully than I can detect. Let me explain why students are the ones losing the most in this environment and why instructors like me feel pretty much powerless to fix the problem. Do or do not, there is no AI. Students often carry misconceptions about coursework. They may view an instructor as an opponent standing in the way of the grade they want, and they see getting the right answers as the goal of education because that's how you secure that grade. But that's no more true than thinking that logging a count of reps is the goal of bodybuilding. The hard work of lifting weights is the point because that yields physical results. A popular analogy is that using an LLM to write your essay is like driving a forklift into the weight room. Weights get lifted, sure, but nothing is accomplished. I'm not hoping you can answer the exam question for me. I don't need your essay to get me out of a jam. The process of doing the work was what you needed to walk away with something. In a recent video about how easy Sora has made it for users to generate relatively realistic but deeply problematic videos, Hank Green rubbed his eyes as he shouted in the figurative direction of OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, "The friction matters, Sam!" Green could just as well have been describing the process of learning. If there's no friction, no effort, then no work occurred and the student hasn't learned. They would have been no less productive watching paint dry. There are some questions in my course assignments that require critical thought to extend ideas beyond the material I've taught. For example, one asks them to stumble on the concept of a natural experiment by thinking of a way to study wind erosion without waiting many lifetimes for a particular boulder to erode. An experiment with a very different kind of control group than the examples we discussed beforehand, like placebos in medical trials. Noticing a shift, I recently reviewed all 279 answers I received to the question since I started asking it in 2019. Before ChatGPT, about 1 in 3 successfully figured it out, independently connecting pretty potent dots for scientific thinking rather than passively absorbing another fact. For the past 2 years, the success rate has climbed to over half. There's no great mystery here. The terms ChatGPT uses when prompted with this question now appear frequently. Students might consider this a case of simply looking up information, which a majority of them rate as the most helpful and acceptable use of LLMs in surveys. But typing a question and relaying the response is not the same as thinking about it. A question like this is what we call formative assessment. I never graded the correctness of the answer, only the effort. The point was to find out if the core concept had really clicked, or if that student still needed a little help making the connection. Failure is a useful part of learning when the stakes are low, as they are during the bulk of the class. Encountering this question on the final exam would be an entirely different interaction. What's the point of building formative assessments into a course if they're just handed off to an LLM? Suddenly, it's a waste of time for both the student and the instructor. Small quizzes are excellent study tools to help students check their own understanding, if a student does them. Now, you can direct an agentic LLM browser to complete all the quizzes in an entire course with a single frictionless prompt. Should instructors preserve these sorts of assignments for students who want to benefit from them and accept the cheating, or should they eliminate the learning opportunity just to prevent cheating? Evolution, the natural selection. Many instructors are trying to adapt to this crisis by going back to the only evaluation tools that are pretty much LLM-proof, tests like oral exams or handwritten work created under supervision in the classroom. None of these solutions are available to instructors of asynchronous online classes. That sucks, since the availability of those classes is important. They can serve students with physical disabilities, students in rural areas far from a campus, or students trying to obtain a degree while working full-time jobs or caring for dependents. If we have to simply give up on the idea of online classes, those are the casualties. But even for in-person classes, adaptations to prevent LLM cheating are often concessions that reduce pedagogical quality. For example, labour-intensive oral exams didn't become an endangered species just because of the swelling student-to-instructor ratio. Pen and paper or keyboard and mouse exams make it easier for each student's experience to be the same and remove some of the potential for bias in scoring. Writing assignments that may previously have been excellent teaching tools have obviously become the first things to end up on the chopping block. I used to have students in a natural disasters class write a plot for a big budget Hollywood disaster movie using both accurate and implausible physical processes. It was good practice for their writing skills, the students found it enjoyable, and it forced them to skillfully apply a lot of what they had learned. But LLMs will spit out an essay shaped like this in 10 seconds flat. While these are easily recognisable and low quality, the assignment becomes untenable. I could grade a real student's paper in 15 to 30 minutes, but dealing with each instance of cheating easily ran 4 to 8 frustrating and depressing hours of work, so I simply had to cut it from the course. In times of old, instructors bemoaning issues with plagiarism were often, sometimes condescendingly, told that perhaps they should try creating good assignments instead of ones that can be easily completed with a bit of old copy and paste. Instead of asking students to define terms or summarise a concept when Wikipedia is sitting right there, the advice was to give them higher level tasks, to evaluate different solutions to a problem or reflect on how that concept has come up in their own lives. A higher quality assignment would be more engaging and harder to cheat on. But now, prompting ChatGPT to bluff a reflection is no harder than prompting it to define terms. Both are easier than plagiarising Wikipedia ever was. And it's all incredibly difficult to prosecute by our traditional standards of cheating because there is no incontrovertible test for LLM use. That cuts both ways. It also means that innocent students who are wrongly accused often can't prove they did the work honestly. I'm not alone in feeling exasperated by this predicament. A survey of about 3,000 college faculty showed that 85% felt LLMs make students less likely to develop critical thinking abilities, and 72% reported challenges managing LLM use. Predictably, the response from higher education administrators, who are busy signing contracts for institutional LLM subscriptions to show how future-first their thought leadership is, has been to tell instructors that their job is to teach students how to use AI effectively. Most examples of this effective use involve students generating an essay with AI and then critiquing it, as if the internet wasn't bursting at the seams with human writing that one could critique. Every time I've asked an instructor what their learning objective was for this assignment, the answer has been to help students see why they shouldn't trust an LLM to write for them. Stop me when you notice the contradiction between that and the administrator's wishes. Even if you find creative and highly structured activities in which the guardrails lead to course-relevant learning occurring during the class period, the question remains, what impact are LLMs having on those students for the other 23 hours of the day? The reason this feels so different to teachers than the tech panics of the past is that there is no clear solution to how AI is undermining nearly every aspect of education. It's a strange game trying to get students to do things you think will help their education while they point LLMs at you, and it too often feels like the only winning move is not to play. Disruption without construction. Instructors burned out with the current situation endure a barrage of repetitive bromides. It's the future, better get used to it. Can you at least give me some good lottery numbers, oh great and powerful time traveller? Luddites once said we shouldn't use calculators. You mean the way math instructors generally restrict the use of calculators, which notably do not hallucinate false answers when teaching many skills? LLMs are personal tutors. Would you hire a tutor who plays two truths and a lie? It doesn't seem like anyone wants to listen to instructors explain how bad it feels to try to do our job in the presence of this annihilative education antimatter. Instead, we're offered AI grading tools to score AI-generated submissions for AI-generated assignments. Perhaps critics like me just don't understand the AI revolution, whatever that is, but we all have experience with human nature and the well-worn patterns of students. LLMs are a shortcut. Students often take shortcuts they later regret. We've all been there. As an instructor, I want to build a clear path up the mountain for my students and see them reach the top. Instead, I increasingly feel like I'm just playing impossible defense to keep them moving every direction but up. It's exhausting and I will mostly lose, which means I'm not even helping them. Students really do want to climb up there, but it's always tempting to skip some mountains. A few months ago, I overheard some college students talk about their classes. One was complaining about an assignment they needed to do that night, and another incredulously asked why they wouldn't just have ChatGPT do it. The first replied, "This is my major. I actually need to learn stuff in this class. I use AI for my other classes." I haven't encountered any students who think they're learning when they let LLMs do their work, despite the face that college administrators and LLM advertising try to put on this. It's just workload management to them. Who knows what will happen if the AI bubble pops and the frictionless and ubiquitous access to LLMs withers into something much more limited. But while AI is here, it certainly isn't revolutionising education and enhancing learning. It's just making it extraordinarily difficult to do all the things that have been helping students learn for a very long time. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much for that, Andy. And here we have Dale, who's going to tell us how important the humanities are now more than ever.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from The Educator by Katrina Davey. Katrina Davey is the author of Humming Along, Achieving Excellence in Teaching Primary and Secondary Humanities. Australia needs the humanities now more than ever. If you asked educators across Australia what the world needs most right now, few would answer better NAPLAN scores or more explicit instruction. What educators, young people, and society in general are all seeking right now is a greater sense of humanity. Yet, where do the humanities sit in our national education priorities? The past decade has been dominated by literacy and numeracy headlines and a push towards STEM as the key to Australia's future. In the process, the humanities have slipped into the shadows, from national policy to school leadership decisions, and now this long-term oversight might be coming back to bite. Social discord and activism have risen dramatically in Australia, with 2025 marked by weekly protests drawing large crowds. As government leaders grapple with rising division and a weakening sense of national identity among young adults, humanities educators are unsurprised. They have watched their subject repeatedly sidelined and undervalued despite being the learning area that teaches empathy, ethics, identity, global awareness, and civic responsibility. As Sir Robert Menzies outlined in 1945, the study of humanities in the schools and universities can at least develop a sense of proportion. The first function of education is to produce a good citizen. The humanities remain central to that mission. Since the launch of the Australian curriculum, humanities and social sciences has faced significant structural challenges. Its content has increased dramatically, transforming it into an umbrella for history, geography, civics and citizenship, and economics and business. Yet the time allocated to teach all these disciplines has barely changed. Therefore, the implementation of all four areas is haphazard, with some topics omitted by schools or taught on a biannual basis or squeezed in at the end of a school year when brevity outcompetes depth. Furthermore, except history, all other disciplines are shifted into the elective basket for years 9 and 10. And this is the calamity that I believe has led to our current social climate. At the very age when adolescents are most impressionable, most influenced by social media, most inclined to take risks, and least connected to other generations, humanities becomes optional, no longer viewed as important as English, maths, or science. Think how this instantly shapes a student's perspective towards the humanities. When schools make the humanities a series of electives, it implies key life decisions and skills are no longer necessary. As a teacher of adolescents, I have always felt that studying human empathy, ethics, integrity, and responsibility is most heavily needed in year 10. This is when identity, character, and reasoning patterns become embedded. In upper secondary, humanities students can broaden their worldliness and understanding of current affairs, analyze historical events through an ethical lens, develop their systems thinking to appreciate the complexities of an interconnected world, and explore case studies highlighting the strength of Australia's democracy and justice system. The sting is sharper still at a tertiary level, where humanities degrees have also been politically devalued, a concern raised by outgoing University of New South Wales Chancellor David Gonski, who urged universities to encourage, not deter, humanities studies. The consequence of sidelining the humanities are now visible in national data. Civics education is flailing, with only 28% of Year 10 students reaching the proficient standard in the latest National Civics Assessment, the lowest result in two decades. Considering this, it should not surprise us that youth crime is rising. Many young people have never been taught why our legal system is worth respecting, and this ignorance negatively impacts society. Democratic confidence is fragile, and without the humanities, students remain oblivious to what democracy actually protects in this country. The lack of economics and geography taught in the upper secondary years is also detrimental for an adolescent's future readiness. Recent calls to embed financial literacy in early primary mathematics again elevated maths on the national agenda, but failed to consider the role of economics in teaching vital financial literacy skills. What about the necessity of understanding the economic aspects of an adult's working life? Interest rates, superannuation, taxation, inflation, and employment are all daily financial realities. Yet these crucial topics are taught in year 9 and 10 when economics is only optional. Meanwhile, geography provides an essential understanding of global issues, resource depletion, climate change, environmental systems, and the human cooperation required for a sustainable future. These are not niche topics. They are foundational to becoming a responsible global citizen. The humanities umbrella, when taught in its entirety, helps students understand the flow-on effects of actions and decisions made across the world. Just think about the holistic understanding of civics, economics, geography, and history that students would need to understand the current events of 2026. As global democratic norms come under pressure and long-term tensions in the Middle East erupt into conflict, we are seeing our dependency on unsustainable resources like oil exacerbated, causing inflation to rise further. To understand this complex web of events and its impact on our daily lives requires a sophisticated understanding of the humanities. Behind these structural challenges also lies a workforce reality. Confident, multidisciplinary humanities educators are rare. School leadership teams often reassign trained humanities teachers to teach English, maths, and science to prioritize NAPLAN outcomes. And therefore, many other teachers are thrust into the subject out of field, anxious and underprepared. It is yet another reflection of a system that has not invested in the humanities with the seriousness it deserves. A call to rehumanize the national education agenda. This is why I wrote Humming Along, Achieving Excellence in teaching primary and secondary humanities. The book is a rallying cry for educators who believe the heart of schooling lies in helping young people navigate complexity with compassion and a sense of wonder. Humming Along offers practical, research-informed strategies to help humanities teams hum. From curriculum design and authentic assessment to brand identity, well-being aware leadership, and cross-disciplinary collaboration. It is written with deep empathy for teachers juggling multiple disciplines and striving to deliver meaningful learning in a crowded curriculum. Its early uptake among tertiary lecturers and pre-service teachers signals a growing recognition that the humanities matter and that teachers need support to teach them well. A strong humanities education delivered by a passionate teacher is the antidote to division and the foundation of social cohesion. It is how we build ethical thinkers, informed citizens, and globally aware young people who can navigate a future of uncertainty, whether it be rapid technological advancements, climate change, or geopolitical conflicts. Humanities as a subject holds a responsibility just as important as maths, English, or STEM. We are teaching the subject that ensures our future is humane. We are teaching for the sake of humanity. And it's time Australia recognised that. Katrina Davey is the author of Humming Along, Achieving Excellence in Teaching Primary and Secondary Humanities. And I must admit, I wholeheartedly agree with Katrina Davies' assessment. The humanities are not only being devalued, but also priced out, with some universities scrapping entire humanities faculties in favour of more lucrative business studies. I'm again reminded of how valuable my public education was. We did economics, we did French and Japanese language, we did history, geography, and we did what was called SOS, Study of Society, which was a mixture of politics and sociology. These subjects were not moved to elective options until year 10, meaning that every student had to do at least 2 years of study in these areas. And while for a 14-year-old, economics might have seemed a little dry with its cost analysis, formulae for calculating percentages in hire purchase agreements, and household income budgeting, as a school leaver, financial management was not a foreign concept. And SOS was and remains one of my favourite subjects. Analysing Mao's Long March, grasping neoliberal Reaganomics, and understanding Gorbachev's perestroika might have seemed remote concerns for young teenagers in rural Queensland, but our comprehension of basic political theory garnered robust and informed discussion. Today's parroting of idiomatic, usually American slogans, bespeaks the ignorance created in the vacuum of humanities this world of metrics-driven information exchange has created. And it's pathetic. The sheer amount of people who use the term socialist as an insult, yet are unable to factually define what it means, while at the same time bemoaning that they don't have better healthcare, exemplifies the dangerous disconnect created by devaluing humanities. Okay, that's just my two cents. Rant over. Back to you, Jean.
Oh, Dale, thank you so much for your passion. Let's have a break.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
3CR. I hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. We're not going to have our usual Great State School this week, but we've got a very interesting article by John Frew.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by John Frew. Half the truth. Defending public education requires more honesty, not less. Criticism of public schools is not entirely wrong, but by ignoring unequal conditions, it misdiagnoses the problem and misplaces responsibility. There has been a steady stream of criticism of public education in recent months. Stories of teacher shortages, classroom disruption, declining outcomes, and growing parental dissatisfaction are now familiar. For many who have spent their lives in public education, the reaction is immediate and understandable. The criticism feels unfair, exaggerated, even ideological. It is often dismissed as another round of teacher bashing. But there is a problem with that response. Much of what's being reported is, in fact, true. Teachers are leaving. Classrooms are more difficult to manage. Workload is unsustainable. In many schools, learning is increasingly fragile. To deny this is not a defence of public education, it's a weakening of it. The real issue is not that the media is wrong, it is that the story being told is only half the truth. The public narrative describes what is happening, but not why. It reports disruption, falling results, and stressed teachers, but rarely examines the conditions that produce them. Instead, the explanation quietly shifts towards schools and teachers themselves, towards leadership, teaching quality or school culture. The implication is subtle but powerful. Improvement is possible everywhere, and where it is not occurring, something is being done wrong. This implication is reinforced by a parallel narrative, the celebration of success. We are shown schools that have turned around, principals who have lifted outcomes, communities that have transformed performance. These stories are genuine and often inspiring, but they are also selective. They present success without context, and in doing so create a benchmark that quietly condemns those working under very different conditions. The question is not whether these success stories are real, the question is what they leave out. Public education is increasingly being judged as if it operates within a uniform system. It does not. Schools now operate across a spectrum of conditions that are fundamentally different. At one end are schools with relatively stable student populations, strong parental alignment, and manageable behavioural expectations. At the other are schools dealing with high levels of trauma, chronic behavioural dysregulation, and community instability and complex social need. To treat these schools as equivalent is to misunderstand the system entirely. Yet policy settings, performance measures, and public reporting continue to assume that they are. NAPLAN and HSC results are compared across schools as if they reflect teaching quality alone. Attendance data is used as a proxy for engagement without regard to the conditions influencing it. Behaviour is reported as an outcome rather than understood as a driver of all other outcomes. This is not simply an analytical error, it is a structural one. Modern education policy is increasingly driven by what can be measured. Literacy and numeracy scores, attendance rates, and retention figures. These are important, but they are not sufficient. They tell us what is happening, but not what is required to make learning possible. In many schools, the primary work is not the delivery of curriculum, but the stabilisation of the environment in which curriculum might eventually be delivered. Teachers are managing behaviour, regulating emotional states, managing safety, and creating the conditions for even brief moments of engagement. This work is complex, skilled, and essential, but it is largely invisible within current measurement systems. What is visible are the outcomes that follow or fail to follow. At the same time, another process is quietly reshaping the system. Many of the most capable teachers are leaving the most complex public school environments. They're not leaving teaching, they are leaving conditions. They move to schools where behaviour is more predictable, where classrooms are stable, and where resources support their work. In those environments, teaching becomes sustainable again. The contrast is striking. Teachers who once worked in highly disrupted classrooms describe a return to settings where learning can proceed without constant interruption, not because they have changed, but because the environment has. This matters because it creates a compounding effect. The schools facing the greatest challenges are also those losing the greatest expertise. As experienced teachers leave, remaining staff carry increasing complexity with fewer supports. Behaviour becomes harder to manage, workload intensifies, and outcomes decline. These outcomes are then reported as evidence of failure. This is where the narrative becomes most problematic, when outcomes are compared without context and success stories are presented without qualification. Responsibility shifts. It shifts away from system design and towards those working within its most difficult conditions. Teachers in the most complex schools are judged against benchmarks produced in more stable environments. Their work, often focused on maintaining safety, regulating behaviour and preventing escalation, is not reflected in the data used to evaluate them. What is reflected are results that are structurally harder to achieve. And so the conclusion, rarely stated but widely implied, is that these schools and those who work in them are not doing enough. Those who care about public education often respond by rejecting the criticism altogether. They point to underfunding, inequality, and broader social pressures, and rightly so. But if the defence stops there, it is incomplete. Defending public education requires more than identifying external pressures. It requires acknowledging the internal variation within the system and the consequences of treating unequal conditions as if they were equal. It requires saying clearly that outcomes are not produced by effort alone, and that schools working under fundamentally different conditions cannot be judged by identical measures. It also requires acknowledging that the system is, in fact, redistributing both students and teachers in ways that intensify these differences. Until that's recognised, the narrative of failure will continue, and it will continue to fail most heavily on those working in the most demanding environments. The current media coverage is not entirely wrong, but it is incomplete. It describes the symptoms of a system under strain while overlooking the structures that produce that strain. It highlights success, but without explaining the conditions that make it possible. It reports failure, but without acknowledging how that failure is distributed. In that gap between description and explanation, a distorted picture emerges, and within that distortion, responsibility is misplaced. If public education is to be defended effectively, it will not be through denial. It will be through clarity, through a willingness to say that the system is not uniform, that outcomes are context dependent, and that those working in the most complex environments are not failing, they are carrying a burden the system has not yet learned to recognise. Only when the full story is told can a meaningful response begin. Indeed. Back to you, Jean.
Our time is gone. If you want to hear more about the dogs, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. But it is bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize. Went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.